This is a meeting of the Cleveland Park Citizens Association that was held on Thursday, April 19th at 6:30 until 8:30 p.m. About 16 people were originally in attendance for the first part of the business meeting that grew to about 20, 25 for the actual presentation. There were over 30 people present. Most of this recorded well, but there were several points at which speakers either did not use the microphone or turned it off or did not speak anywhere near the microphone. And we had to cut out several sections of several minutes of silence. But otherwise, the recording quality was pretty good. In the absence of the president, the meeting was chaired by the first vice president, Ann Hamilton.
The first thing I have to say is the standard thing about every meeting, which is, that's all right, this is being podcast. So, yeah, he does. Gabe is in charge. Gabe said it was okay. So, if anybody has anything to say at any point during the meeting, please use a microphone. It is not an amplifier. It is simply a recording device. So that's my first message in a great hurry. My second message is that back on the table there are a handful of copies of the minutes of our March 15th membership meeting, which I am obviously confident that you have all read and committed to memory. So if anybody wishes to propose a move to accept those minutes, okay. Do I hear a second of that motion of somebody else who's memorized it? Yeah, okay. All in favor of accepting the minutes? All opposed? The minutes are accepted. Ooh, I'm going great guns so far. Now I'm going to give you a few updates. These are all my instructions from Susie, who is basking in London as we meet here tonight. But she feels terrible that she's not here and keeps sending emails from London. Add this to the agenda. Say that. And I'm saying, hush, just enjoy London. She can't do it. Anyway, the first report is on regulatory matters, in which Susie asked me to report that our speaker, an excellent new pal, Sandra Matavus Fry, the People's Counsel, the replacement for our former friend, Betty Noel, has been renominated by the mayor for a second term as People's Counsel, which is good news for those of us who care about the people part of the People's Counsel. Secondly, Ruth, I'm reporting on the website, Ruth has been working, like Ruth Kaplan, like crazy on the website. Dana McCormick, whom most of you know as a friend and neighbor, is helping to set up, organizing a new website, and she's moving right along. We're trying to make it visually appealing and informative, which I'm sorry to say can no longer be said about our current website. So I think you'll all see a very happy improvement. No matter what it does, it's going to be better. The design of the homepage is almost complete now, thanks to Ruth and constant reviewing of their work. The other good news is that it will have online membership capability, so people can sign up online and the database will be moved to online. They can pay online. That's our move at least into the late 20th century and perhaps even into the 21st century. And we hope to have a proposal ready for next month's membership meeting. If there is a God, we will. Susie asked me to update you on Connecticut Avenue. First, about the fire station, which we have been missing for a long time and stand to miss for a little bit longer, but things are moving along. The mayor's agent did approve the widening and heightening of the doors. This is a historical sadness, but a safety improvement, and he opted that way. Public safety right now, darn thing has been closed for more than a year now, I think. It's about time we had our fire station back. And the changes, I hope, won't be too drastic. On the Connecticut Avenue streetscape project, the DDOT team leadership has changed yet again. So, as always with the district government, it's two steps forward and one and a half steps back. But Susie is working like crazy with them, and the CCC, Connecticut Avenue Coalition, and the CPBA Business Association, they're all working hard, and I think relations are being established beautifully to move ahead. There's a wrong street light at Connecticut and Macomb. That's being corrected. There's an angle change at Newark and Connecticut, possibly, and right there. So to help save the lives of pedestrians. And there's a mid-block crosswalk in front of the Uptown. Work should begin in mid-June, unless there is yet another change of the guard. So though Connecticut Avenue is moving along, not nearly as fast as we would have liked, but it's moving. Update on McFadden's. There is no update on McFadden's. There's been no progress in talking to them. Beyond our initial contacts, we have no idea what's going on with either the landlord or McFadden's. The potentially good news, at least for now, is that the Four Fields may actually stay through June, which postpones another empty storefront for another month or two. Yeah, see? I mean, who knows? The short answer is we don't know much yet. Mark Rosenman in particular is knocking himself out to stay in touch. Wait one second, and Mark will report whenever he knows anything, which I believe he does not now. Gene.
The rumor that I heard from the age group that patronizes the Four Fields was that the price that Hughes was asking for the liquor license was unacceptable to McFadden's. And as a result, McFadden's is going to be walking away from interest in that situation. Now, that's just a rumor, and it just comes from kids who drink there. So it doesn't mean it's true, but at least that's the story that I heard.
That's beautiful. Of course, you know, he might lower his price because it's whatever it is, it's going to be a pretty price that of liquor license is a valuable thing. So who knows? Mark, you're in the seat to keep us informed. There's more good news about Cleveland Park Village, the aging in place community. It is really moving along. They're filing an application for 501c3 status with the IRS. They are working on a 3-year business plan, and they expect that services will actually begin no later than the fall of 2013. That is 18 months from now. But that is impressive, considering that it's been about 50 years so far. So 18 months fits nicely into that time frame. Fall of this year, fall of 2012. Oh, boy. Yay. Even better. So, a little short of miraculous. Anyway, whatever. It's finally moving, and this is a wonderful miracle. I mean, how many years ago was it, George, that your meeting developed infinite enthusiasm for the idea? Well, then it just kind of sank slowly into the West. And it's back alive and active and actually happening. Only 3 announcements. Our next meeting, our May meeting, is focusing on the ever-important question of crime prevention. There's been a marked increase in crime. For anybody who reads the Cleveland Park listserv will be well aware. Robberies and thefts in and around Cleveland Park are becoming scary. So, in May, Mark, the program committee chair, has organized the police department's chief of patrol chief, Chief Grooms, our own 2nd District Commander, Reese, and a couple of knowledgeable civilians or two, and we can get together and decide how to best to preserve our cars, our property, and not too unimportant our lives. So we're going to talk about why some neighborhoods attract street crime, what communities can do to make their neighborhoods less attractive to criminals, and how we can better keep ourselves safe as we go about our lives. It should be a fascinating and informative meeting, and I urge you all to write down May 17th on your calendars. The next one is a meeting after that, June 14th. A new board and officers will be elected. As Susie has already announced, our own great, fabulous Pam Corbell is chair of the nominating committee, and she hopes to be able to announce by May 14th, a month before the June 14th annual meeting, the committee's nominees for directorships and officerships. So put another thing to write on your calendar: at May 17th, June 14th. Finally, on my list of announcements is, on Susie's behalf, I'm pleased and proud to announce that the CPA board approved and CPCA nominated one of our own stars to be the recipient of the D.C. Federation of Citizens Associations, I love it, 2012 Outstanding Citizen Activist for the whole city, I think. Our nominee won that award. Our nominee, in fact, will receive that award. Mark, can I ask you to open the envelope?
It's Nancy Mackwood, is that? Mackwood, Nancy Mackwood.
Yay! Nancy, I'm sorry she couldn't be here with us tonight, but that is a very happy outcome as far as I am concerned. And that, with 2 minutes to spare, brings us to the end of my announcements and to the question, is there any new business? There is another person keeping the CPCA, the Aging in Place group, alive and active. Yes, Judy. Whoops, sorry, I need another mic. But this will do.
Speaking of rumors, I heard a rumor that 2911, the Macklin, was sold. But it wasn't clear. First of all, it's a rumor. Second of all, it wasn't clear if it was just the apartment building or the apartment building and the restaurant and the retail, the apartment and the retail. So I just throw that out as a possibility.
And then I think the parking lot is yet a third element in that sales equation. So, all right, add that to the rumor mill. That's the most fun part of these meetings anyway. Anybody else have any hot rumors? Oh, yes, George does. Okay.
I don't know whether this is news to anybody, but when and if this library gets refurbished, it will be a mixed-use building. That is the process.
How do you know that? What makes you?
Well, apparently all of them are going to be, from what I hear. I can't prove it, but that's what I hear. Well, it means
apartments above, high rise.
Yeah, it would mean that.
Medium rise. Yeah, mystery, fiction, nonfiction, right? So clearly, and as we all know, the Giant closed on April 13th, which was a sad moment for those of us at least on the other side of 34th and many of us on this side of 34th. And there are signs up now that the parking lot is closing on April 23rd, which is going to be a sad moment not only for us but for the merchants who rely on that parking lot. So we are in for, this community is in for a lot of change. Buckle your seatbelts.
When okay. I went by yesterday, the G and the I were being taken down.
Oh, they're all gone now. They're all gone. And the neon light is gone. The all signage is gone. Yeah. George took G for George. And the I. Oh, no. Oh, my God. How perfect. There's no E in giant, though. What are you going to do? Okay. It is now my pleasure to turn the meeting over to the chair of the Greening Committee, who has just done yeoman service in keeping us conscious and aware of the environmental impact of our lives. None other than, Mark, would you open the envelope? Ruth Kaplan.
I don't know if any of us can beat you as an MC, Anne. You did a great job. Thank you. The program part of the meeting is due to start in just a few minutes, but it's okay to start a few minutes early, which is what we will do. I wanted to begin. Why don't we have our panelists come up, and I'll introduce you in just a minute. And whatever chair you like. Oh, yeah, the nameplate that I didn't make. You can sit right in front of that. Yes. Yeah, that's right. And I'm just going to be over here. That'll work fine. So, again, just to remind you, these mics are because we're podcasting this, and it'll be up on our website. So you'll be immortal. But they don't magnify your voice at all. So you do need to speak up. But it's a small room. It's just a voice. Yes, just voice. So I wanted to begin by just talking a little bit about the context for this meeting. And that is, a couple of years ago, we created the Greening Committee for CPCA. And when we did that, we created a mission, and the mission of our Greening Committee was very ambitious, and that is that we wanted to become a model sustainable community for the country. And now what we have is the whole city wanting to become a model city for the whole country. So it's actually taken quite a load off our shoulders to realize we're not just doing this alone. There's the whole city working on this, which is pretty exciting, actually. Last summer, Mayor Gray talked about starting a process for Sustainable DC. And then in September, it was formally launched. I don't know if any of you have been up on the website, but if you just Google Sustainable DC, it'll pop up for you. Rather than me giving you a URL that nobody will remember, just Google. That'll work for you. It was asking, you know, anybody could put up ideas, you know, any ideas that they had about Sustainable DC, and some of us did that. The end of November, he kicked off a process of 11 working groups. And these were all open to anybody who wanted to participate. And so I participated with Andrea being one of the facilitators in green economics. And I found it was a very interesting process. And, you know, when they came to one meeting with a vision statement and we looked at it and we said, well, we don't like this and we don't like this. Besides, we don't even like the whole thing. And lo and behold, it got modified. And, you know, that was really good. I was a little bit cynical at first. But, you know, I mean, the next time we came to the next meeting, they'd actually heard us. So, you know, for me, that's indicative of the kind of process that's gone on in terms of involving people in this. So I just wanted to mention to you the different working groups that were set up and maybe just, you know, one highlight that each one has come up with. For both jobs and the green economy, They want to double the number of green industry-based local businesses, and these are all by 2032. So each of these have short-term, medium-term, long-term objectives. But the ones that I'm reading are ones that each working group said they wanted by 2032. For health, and this is an interesting take on sustainability, half the citywide obesity rate related to chronic diseases. For the built environment, all new buildings embody high performance standards and produce as much energy as they consume. Pretty cool, huh? Yeah. And also that existing buildings will be retrofitted to have their energy and water use. All buildings, commercial, residential, all buildings. For climate, reduce the citywide greenhouse gas emissions by half and by 80% by 2050. For food, that was climate. For energy, reduce energy consumption by 50%. Increase use of renewable electricity by 50%. So again, very ambitious goals, although I must say I've talked to some people who say they're not nearly ambitious enough. But we'll see. We'll see how we do with these. Food, bring locally grown food within a quarter mile of 75% of the population. And of course, that speaks to having things like urban gardens and more farmers markets. It's one thing that CPCA has been looking at is having a farmers market, you know, right in our immediate neighborhood. There was one on nature, 40% of the district covered by healthy tree canopy. And I know that's something that's been of concern to a lot of people in CPCA. Transportation. At least two-thirds of all trips originating in the city by walking, biking, public transit, or some yet-to-be-discovered clean transportation alternatives. Waste, zero waste. I thought that was really ambitious. Zero waste. Produce less, capture maximum value via reuse, recycling, composting, and waste to energy. The last makes me a little nervous, but we'll see how that goes. And finally, water, 75% of the city's landscape will naturally filter or capture rainwater for reuse. And this is something that Jane and I were just talking about, so we can get into that more. The next step was that the mayor appointed a 20-member Green Ribbon Committee, and he's been meeting with this committee to sort of vet all of these ideas that have been coming out of the working groups, and we're very happy to have Brent, who I'll introduce in a minute, on that committee. So what we're going to do, we want to have lots of time for questions and discussion with everybody here. So everybody on the panel will take about 15 minutes, talk about their perspectives. And while we're doing that, I'd really appreciate it if we could hold questions until after the panel, and then there'll be plenty of time for questions. So make a little mental note of the questions that you want to ask. So with that, welcome to everybody here, and I'd like to introduce our panelists. First is Commissioner of the Public Service Commission, Laurie Murphy Lee, at the end of the panel here. And Laurie, I was just reading a little bit about you. You're a fifth generation Washingtonian. That's really neat. That you've been an attorney with the Department of Justice in the Office of Immigration Review for 12 years, right? Yeah. You joined the Public Service Commission in March of 2009. And you're on the board of the National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners, and chair of the Subcommittee on Energy and Research, Education and Research, yes. For those who don't know, NARUC is probably the preeminent association of regulatory commissioners in the country. Anybody who works on energy has heard of NARUC. And you've also served as the acting president and the vice president of the American Federation of Government Employees. So that's a very diverse and busy life you've been leading. We're very glad to have you with us. Andrea Limaro. is here, and he's with the D.C. Office of Planning. He's our Ward 3 neighborhood coordinator. And a few years ago, I first watched Andrea in action when just north of us in North Cleveland Park, and I guess it included, we're doing sustainability indicators in a very interactive way with people in the neighborhood. So maybe sometime we can do that here. And then I got to know Andrea more as one of the facilitators of the Green Economics Working Group, along with Howard Means from UDC. And I also was looking up a little bit about you before the meeting. And you have a master's in urban planning and policy from University of Chicago at Illinois, University of Illinois at Chicago. And you were the recipient of the Provost Award for graduate research for field work on a World Bank project in the Honduras. So you've been around. Also, that you got a graduate diploma from the University of Padua in Italy and studied in England. So we're glad you've landed here. Brent Blackwelder, I have admired since I first came to D.C. in 1982. I have such images of Brent with a whole passel of lobbyists figuring out the strategy of what to do on a bill. And I you were on some stairs, and the lobbyists were all around you. I have this image, Brent, so clearly in my mind about you. Brent was the founder of the Environmental Policy Institute, which merged with Friends of the Earth in 1989. He was also founder of Friends of the River, right? American Rivers, yes, thank you. Yeah, okay. And he's been president of Friends of the Earth from 1989 until you retired just a few years ago, but you're now president emeritus, right? Okay, good. And, you know, if you think that environmentalists just go down a very, very narrow path, let me say that Brent also has a master's degree in mathematics and a PhD in philosophy. So, you know, again, quite a wide range of interests. And he's a member of the Mayor's Green Ribbon Committee. So I think what we're going to do, Brent, if you would like to begin, and then, Commissioner Lee, if you could talk next. And then, Andrea, if you could talk third. Does that work? Yeah, go ahead. Yes. Thank you. There's been a lot of interest on the listserv about smart meters. And so in having Commissioner Lee come and speak, we talked specifically about sharing with us more the commission's perspective and her perspective on smart meters. So thank you very much for that. All right. Yes, that's good.
Really close on. Yeah, just a little bit about my background. Our family moved here in 1948. Lived at 35th and Lowell. I now live at 35th and Rodman for the past 20 years. So I've never been outside the Beltway, well, except a few other times. But it's a great place to live, and I've really enjoyed living and raising a family here in Cleveland Park. Let me describe some of the interest that Friends of the Earth brought to district, along with the Sierra Club. 16 years ago, we set up the DC Environmental Network because we thought the nation's capital should be a real leader in all categories of environmental performance. But most of the national environmental groups were not focused on the problems of the city, and Congress was not focused on them either. So the network grew and came to have over 100 organizations. National ones, neighborhood ones, citywide ones, and we've won over 25 significant campaigns during the course of that decade and a half. Campaigns that have covered about every single ward of the city. So with that vision we brought there, why can't the district be the best? I was delighted when Mayor Gray put together this task force and a very open planning process to come up with this big vision. I'll just read the latest one that we dealt with at this Green Ribbon Committee, a nice name. And, by the way, it's already expanded beyond the 20 since population development inside the city is desired. We've gone to from 20 to 23 members on this committee, so we're doing our part there to infill the city. This vision says, in just one generation, 20 years, the District of Columbia will be the healthiest, greenest, most livable city in the United States. Wow, that is, yay. Yes, and he goes on, an international destination for people and financial capital, the district will be a model of innovative policies and practices that improve the quality of life and economic opportunity. I mean, they're just on a roll here. We will demonstrate how enhancing our natural and built environments, investing in a diverse, clean economy, and implementing proactive strategies to reduce disparities among citizens can create an educated, equitable, and prosperous society. Very ambitious. Let's see how we're going to come out. And Ruth went over the task forces. I like to think of them as nine-issue task forces. And then you have one on jobs and health, which I think are part of all the other nine, because I believe almost everything being suggested under the categories of food, energy, water, solid waste, have job components, have health components in them. And that's the way it should be. Then it's really you're getting a result if you go that way. So I think the process has been really open to a lot of suggestions. And they've received, according to their records, over a thousand set of recommendations. And they've held 125 public meetings and events, which is pretty darn good if you consider, at least in my experience, how hard it's been to get a lot of federal agencies even to condescend to answer a phone call, much less do a public hearing. So I think we've got a pretty fair and open process. But the crunch time will come when you get past the opening announcement. And the opening announcement, the kickoff, will be April 24th with two events, one at 11 a.m. on the at the Anacostia on the Trail Bridge. Everybody's invited, and showing up and supporting this will help give it more momentum. Then from 6:30 to 8:30 at the Florida Avenue Baptist Church, there's going to be another presentation and rollout. So those are either one or both of those events I would encourage you to attend. The proof of the action, though, will be when we actually move forward with implementation. And I believe the Green Ribbon Panel is going to continue in existence, because at the last meeting held earlier this month, we asked questions. Well, it's important to separate these recommendations, some of which Ruth gave you, into things that can be done by the mayor through executive order or through the executive branch action. And those are the easiest ones. So we want to get most of those that can be done that way that we like done. Second, there will be some that simply require the money, and the mayor's got to put it in the budget request. And then it becomes the council, and we can put pressure there to get it approved. A little step further is when you not only need money, but you actually need a new policy or a goal or something set into law, so the council would have to write it, the mayor and the agencies involved. And by the way, he's got the whole raft of agencies. If you're interested, I've got the list here. And then finally, the hardest of all will be doing things which will involve Virginia and Maryland. I mean, things that have to do with Metro and Metro funding, we can try to do as much as we can here, but you've got a problem there. And I mentioned the DC Environmental Network, a couple of things that we have had a problem with. We can win it in the council, such as when we, for clean air, we got some fees charged on commuters only to have Congress override it. And so that can always be a stifling problem for us. So one of the
one of the concerns that people have had about all of these recommendations, and they're fairly substantial. I brought with me the two papers if you want to look at this, and you can get these off of the website, Sustainable DC. Are we putting too much of a burden on all the agencies to have to implement it? And I would argue, no, that is not the case, because what I see us doing here with some of these, we are making the city so much more of a healthy place, whether we're talking about doing water or buildings or clean energy or healthy food, that we will, having a healthier population, we will be reducing a lot of the medical bills, I would hope, and not have so much childhood asthma, lead in kids' bloods. Those are specific goals under the health effort. So there's this synergism that I think can happen. And it's also the case that in looking and talking to what's happened in other cities, the more you can do in a joint way, the more momentum and support you get. Otherwise, you're left with only getting a few things done, and that's not enough given where we need to be. And think of it this way: if you've got the water initiative actually supporting the green roofs as a way of reducing runoff, that also ties into what the energy department would have to be doing to cut energy use, because green roofs are a way of reducing temperatures, keeping buildings cooler, moderating the temperature. So you got a two-for-one there, where they're working together. And I see that almost every single recommendation, we've got a way in which agencies can work together to achieve all of these broad goals. And when we talk to people about them, I think we can emphasize that all of these ideals we talk about, getting fuller employment, making kids healthier, getting rid of a lot of the serious pollution problem, cleaning up the Anacostia, they all fit together under a very broad desirable objectives. And if the nation's capital can actually do this, we'll start to get a reputation for being real leaders. And I tell you, growing working as head of Friends of the Earth, we're in 75 countries, Friends of the Earth International, and the kinds of reputation that we have had here in the city internationally, judging by their comments, they say, you all have got a mayor who's made his own license plates. They didn't quite put it that way, but I mean, they didn't have a single good thing to say about what they had heard of living in the city of Washington, D.C. It's an embarrassment. I say, why can't we be the shining example? I think we've got the basis here, and the mayor has indicated at the last meeting he's okay with these recommendations. So I think if we give that support, then we will get a lot of these through. Where we think they're insufficiently good, there's room to make them better, every single one of them. Let's see, am I about out of time? Yeah, okay. I will note, you went to about 10 after there, Ruth. I'm going to finish in 10 minutes, but I just wanted to note, one of the other good recommendations I liked is environmental literacy in the schools. One of the biggest problems we have is the nature deficit disorder. And today, so many kids simply have no clue of what it is to be outdoors. They don't know how things function together. As knowledgeable as I've tried to become, the more I learn, the more I realize that I'm probably an ecological ignoramus in terms of understanding how the dynamic systems that make the earth teeming with life, how they all work. Who, in fact, really understands it? The more you know, the more you realize that we have very little clue as to how many species of life there are on the earth. Yet we're in the process of doing some really awful things to all of these robust ecosystems. So I think with some good education, we bring the next generation up. And I think also that with so many of these jobs coming in cleaning up the water, cleaning up the air, cleaning up the buildings, bringing clean energy. And that's a good goal we have, by the way, that 50% of our energy is going to come from renewable energy, and there's a strong solar initiative. So I think those are some of the things that I welcome some questions on, and we could have some discussion. But in any case, overall, I just encourage you to get behind this. If there are things you think are not quite right or could be better, let any of us that are on the committee know. And I'm in the phone book, and my email is brentblackwelder@yahoo.com.
Thank you. Ruth, if you don't mind, we actually had a little...
That's fine.
It's on.
Yeah.
And we decided that maybe I should go first because my topic connects directly with
sure.
Brent's.
Go ahead.
So I work for the DC Office of Planning. We are the agency, together with DDOE, that were tasked by the mayor to develop the sustainability plan. And I personally work on the Green Economy Work Group with Ruth. I see Judy came to many meetings and maybe some other people. I'm not sure. But anyway, there was a considerable number of community residents involved. I'm not going to talk about specific goals that came out, also because the plan itself now is under review and we're, you know, working on it, and because we have to release it. And I think as Brent said, maybe he didn't say it, but we ended up with 900 recommendations. So clearly, 900 recommendations do not make a plan. They just make a list of things. So we need to organize them. We need to analyze them. We need to make sure that they make sense. And above all, we need to prioritize them, right? We have to make sure that we know what's going to cost what and what's going to give us what result. And so we need to do that analysis, and it takes some time when you have 900 recommendations, and you need to bring in expertise on, you know, anything from waste to energy, food and whatnot. So that's what we're doing now. Just want to reiterate what Brent said. On Tuesday the 24th, the mayor will be releasing the pre-plan, we call it the vision plan. It's going to be a very short version of what's to come, which is going to be called the implementation plan, the longer plan with all the details and all the actions. But he really insisted that we release something quickly to give people kind of an idea of what's to come and also to build on the momentum. Because when you have all these meetings, all these people that spend all these hours in our boring meetings and put all this energy into it, and then it takes us 8 months to come with a plan, you kind of kill the energy. So we want to do a pre-release, and it's on Tuesday. It's a public meeting. The mayor will be there, and I think he will actually be releasing some pre-legislation. He's so excited about this that he's actually already considering putting in front of council some legislation that will address some of the low-hanging fruit that don't need for us to come up with a full plan. So the details will be released by the mayor on Tuesday. So I really recommend that you attend it. It's going to be at the evening session is going to be at the Florida Avenue Baptist Church. And if you don't know where that is, I actually have a map here and I can show you, but it's in Shaw. So, having said that, the details are coming, but I just wanted to give you some things to ponder about. When the mayor says, hey, we should make DC the cleanest, greenest, most sustainable city in the U.S., well, he wasn't the first person to claim that, right? I mean, there have been other cities that have said, we want to be the cleanest, greenest, but there is a difference. This is the capital of the economic powerhouse of the world, political, military, whatever you want it to be. But it's different when DC says we want to be the most sustainable city in the U.S. rather than some other city. And I'm not going to name names, not to offend anybody. But clearly, there's something that goes beyond our carbon footprint in the city. If Mexico City became greener than us, they clearly would have an advantage in the amount of carbon dioxide that they would minimize compared to our small little city. But we have a political advantage. We can be the showcase for the world. We have something like 16 million people that come and visit DC every year. Not many cities that can equal that. And the people that come and see DC come and see the capital of the U.S. So if you make the capital of the U.S. a showcase of how life can be in an urban area and how it can be better under whatever indicator of sustainability you choose, it becomes very powerful. And, you know, there are 16 million of those are tourists, but there's a quite smaller number of them who are congressmen, right? And, you know, some of them, they doubt some of the things that some people believe and the doubt that we, you know, should spend money on public transportation and the doubt climate change and the doubt this and that. And I think it's very powerful if when decision makers have to come and live in D.C., no matter where their political thinking is, they come and live in this city, they have to. And we show them that public transit actually works, that it's beautiful if people can go to play, work, buy, do whatever they need to do on foot, and it's safe because we have sidewalks in the city, because, you know, you can bike. It's very powerful. Because then they have to go back to their states and say, well, actually, I've seen that work. I've seen that work in D.C. And, you know, building on what Brent was saying, you know, D.C. used to have a name to it that I'm not going to say, but, you know, it was the murder, blah, 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 of. What if we, you know, it's very powerful to shift that in 20 years to the green capital. It's very, very big. And so it's not just about us. It's not just about our neighborhoods. It's not just about our little carbon footprint. We are a relatively small city. But it's about the power of becoming a showcase for the U.S., the other states, and the world. People come here to work at the World Bank, IMF, and whatnot. So it's very important. That's what I think makes it special. So that's one, you know, thing to keep in mind. The other one is, you know, it's funny, but DC has actually made a ton of progress on sustainability without a plan. And that's not to take away from the plan, but it's just to say that we are actually a great city and we have been doing great things. And I think the good thing about having a plan is that it can guide us to go even further. I mean, we enacted the Green Building Act before anybody else. We have more LEED buildings than anybody else. We're second or first, depends how you count things. But, you know, we are second or first on green roofs. Always depends on how you count, but we are top on pretty much everything. I mean, Capital Bike Share, we top any other cities on that. You know, our transit system, there are some problems, right? But it's a great transit system. I mean, second to New York, we can go anywhere. And people use it every day to go to places, to work. So we're doing great things. So now some of the challenges, you know. Energy. We have tripled our solar energy in the past 10 years or something like that. I mean, we're being very aggressive on solar. We're being very aggressive on renewable energies. But if you know what our PEPCO bill, the breakdown of where our energy comes from, it's really depressing. It's really all coal and nuclear power. So we have a long way to go on that. Waste, that's one area where we're behind a lot of comparable cities in waste diversion. But I think at the core, I've been working on sustainability, but at the core I'm a city planner, so I always look at things as a city planner. And I think one thing that strikes me is in 2010 we had the big census, right? And the first, I think it was the first 15 months since the 2010 census was released, we've had an increase in population of 16,000 new residents. So as a planner, as a city planner, which I am at the core, that, you know, I've got bells ringing everywhere. We're growing. This city is growing. A lot of cities in the U.S. are not growing. They're shrinking. You know about Detroit and all the farm movement there. What does it mean to become sustainable as a growing city? You're trying to lower your energy consumption. At the same time, you're getting more people come in, right? You're trying to improve your metro system, but at the same time, we're getting more people who are going to want to use metro. So as a growing city, we have new challenges. But at the same time, we also have new opportunities. New people with their taxes make our city more efficient, because when you have more people condensed in smaller areas and you share infrastructure with them and everybody pays taxes, you've got some opportunities there. More people mean more vibrant streets. Everybody's going to want to go to your restaurants, everybody. So there's challenges and opportunities, but that's something to think about. And this trend is not stopping. In fact, the sustainability plan calls for more growth. But whether we want it or not, it's not stopping. The whole region is growing. This is the only or one of the few regions in the U.S. that keeps on growing. And the projections are that we grow more. We're going to grow more. The question to you as a resident is, as a region, should we grow more in Northern Virginia, or should we grow more in the district? And what does that mean for us, our taxes, our services, and the way our neighborhoods look? And how does that tie into sustainability? So as a city planner, I look at population, I look at how land uses can host and how they should work in that. And I think, you know, a lot of times we focus on, you know, the solar panel and, you know, the bike lane, but really it has been shown that the most efficient and sustainable way to tackle our environmental challenges is really in smart land uses and how you grow. We're a growing country. We're not just a growing region. So where are all these people going to go? I mean, we don't want any more Phoenix, right? Or Las Vegas. I mean, you can't grow in deserts. So that's just something to think about. And then finally, it's inclusion and diversity. We can grow. That's fine. But who's coming already? What kind of people are coming in? What kind of city were we? What kind of city do we want to become? And clearly, this city is changing a lot. So a sustainability plan shouldn't just be about carbon footprint. It should be about being inclusive. Right now, we have an unemployment rate that is just below 10%. It's not great. But what's most more awful about it is that in Ward 3, the unemployment rate is 2%. In Ward 8, it's like, you know, 24%. That's what I heard. It might be higher. But so are we going to be a sustainable city if a quarter of the people in some of our areas don't have jobs? So how do we create jobs? And maybe sustainability might be a key to that, right? I mean, what if we create more green jobs, and where are these green jobs going to be leveraged from? Is it stormwater? Renewable energy. And that's kind of what we're trying to do. I mean, the mayor said from day one to us, to the Office of Planning and DDOE, I want the sustainability plan. I want us to be the greenest and most sustainable city in the U.S., but I want you to focus on jobs. He wanted a sustainability plan that creates jobs. That's another challenge, but I see a lot of potential there. But that's something that, you know, everybody should think about.
Good evening. Can you hear me? Okay. Can you hear me now? No? Okay. Well, if you can't hear me, please let me know, and I will try to speak up. Okay? Okay, so first, let me just say that we at the Commission are delighted with Sustainable DC, and we are willing to support it in any way that we can. And so we are thrilled with the plan. And you know, your Brent had mentioned about the ambitious goals. The more ambitious, the better. So first, I would like to talk a little bit about the Commission, and I will tell you some of our initiatives in terms of greening and saving, and also I will talk about smart meters. So the DC Public Service Commission was established in 1913 through Congress. We are an independent agency, and our mission is to ensure that financially healthy utilities provide safe, reliable, and adequate natural gas, electric, and telecommunication services to our residential, business, commercial, and government consumers. So at the Commission, we act as like quasi-judges, and we are constantly balancing the needs of the community and the company, making sure it's healthy and providing you with that safe and adequate service at reasonable rates. So first, let me say, in terms of going back to this, the sustainability plan, first, when you talk about fuels, you mentioned, you know, he mentioned the yuck fuels, the fossil fuels, you know, dependency fuels, but you know, as far as I'm concerned, the first fuel should be energy efficiency. And that kilowatt that we don't use is the most important. And that's something that we can all do and we all play a role in. And I think that that is the most important thing to keep in mind. Later on this summer, well, later on this year in the summer, we are rolling out, we have approved, and we're rolling out a direct load control program through PEPCO. So this program will allow customers to either through a switch that's on their air conditioning outside or through a in-home display, a thermostat in your home, will allow you to participate in the direct load control program, which means that there are approximately about 10 days a year when, particularly, for example, like in the summer, when it's 90 degrees and everyone wants to, you know, have their air conditioning rolling at top speed, when you will have an opportunity to help the environment and to save money. And the way the program will work is that you will basically agree that on these days you will participate either 50%, 75%, or 100%. And if you participate at the 50% level, you'll get $30 credit, $45 at the 75% level, and $60 at the 100% level. And what that means is that during those particular days, those, you know, days when it's you know, peak load and PJM, which is the regional bulk transmission provider, calls for those particular days, your air conditioning will cycle off. It'll cycle off for either 15 minutes or 22 and a half minutes or 30 minutes every hour. And by doing that, you're allowing there to be less electricity use on the grid during that time. So you're reducing the peak load and you're saving, obviously. I also just wanted to mention that as of May 31st of this year, both Benning Road and Buzzard Point will be decommissioned. So there will be no generation in DC. So we'll, you no longer have to worry about those plants being turned on and any types of emissions coming from those. They will be decommissioned fully. And the Merit plant in Virginia that supplies DC as well will be decommissioned as of October of this year. And so those emissions will not be in the air as well. In place of that, we have worked with Pepco to ensure that we've put in proper transmission so that reliability will not be an issue, that will not be affected. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about the smart meters. The smart meters were, or I should say another way of saying it, advanced metering infrastructure, AMI. In June of 2009, the DC Council passed the Advanced Metering Infrastructure and Cost Recovery Act, 2009, which authorized Pepco to implement an AMI for all customers based on the commission's finding that they received sufficient funds. And those sufficient funds were a 50% grant under the ERA, American... I'm going to say it wrong, AARA, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act that the president put in place, stimulus, if they received sufficient funds, and they received the maximum that any utility could receive. They got 50% paid for by the federal government in order for the installation of smart meters. So in... 2010, they started the rollout of the meters, and the meters will be fully installed by June of this year. They're about 95% installed now, but and they're being activated currently, but they're not fully activated now. So smart meters are going to eliminate estimated bills, because they'll be able to get a full reading of your use. You'll no longer have to worry about an estimated bill. They'll also have two-way communication back to Pepco, so eventually, you know, you won't have to call when you're out of power, and you don't have to worry about, well, you know, everyone else in my block came on, I didn't come on, I better, you know, try to call. They'll know, it'll automatically let them know that. Right now, my account is available. I don't know how many of you all have signed up for that. You can go on Pepco's website, and you can see your hourly usage on my account. The great thing about that is, you know, for example, let's say, you know, you say, you know, I recently bought some new appliances, and they're more energy efficient. They're Energy Star appliances, but for some reason, my bill went up. And so, you know, you can go back and look and say, I wonder why, you know, my bill went up when I had, you know, these new appliances installed. And then you're thinking, wondering, well, perhaps maybe you plugged in your old refrigerator in the garage. And so, whereas you were thinking that you reduced your energy usage, there you have that old one still running. I mean, but those, it can help you to plot, you know, what have I done? You know, was I home all day that day? Did I leave something on? You know, why is my bill so high? Now, in terms of, I know there have been lots of issues raised about the smart meters and, for example, opting out. Does everyone have to have a smart meter? Yes. Currently, everyone has to have a smart meter, and there is no provision to opt out. The council passed the legislation, and it was for everyone to have a meter. And, you know, we have had a request from the Office of the People's Council about the opt-out. And it really is the council's place to make that determination if it is to change. The information that we have indicates that the smart meters are safe, and the radio frequency is at a low level in terms of what has been approved by the Federal Communications Commission. The radio frequency is less than you would receive from a cell phone or a microwave oven or even a baby monitor. So, you know, the information that we have indicates that the meters are are safe. Down the road, while right now currently we do not have any type of dynamic pricing in front of us, that is something that, you know, may come before us at a later date. Okay, sorry. So currently, the way your bill works is it's an averaging of, you know, the cost of electricity. Electricity costs different amounts at different times. So when everyone has their air conditioners blowing on those 90-degree days and everyone's using it and you're peaking, additional power plants have to provide energy. And those are the most expensive. And oftentimes they are, you know, the dirtier ones, but not always. But, you know, your electricity, if you, you know, like, for example, run your washing machine in the peak time of the day, it would cost you X amount. And if you ran it, you know, in the middle of the night when there are very few users, it would be far cheaper. But right now, the company, you know, electricity is just average. That price is just averaged out. So you receive an average of that. With the smart meters and your hourly use, you'll be able to go online and see and have an idea of, you know, at 7 to 9 in the morning is a peak time. Everyone's getting ready to go, you know, start their day. A lot of people are going out to work. So I'm not going to run my dishwasher at that time. You know, I'm going to wait and I'm going to run it in the middle of the day or the middle of the night, like such. Dynamic pricing is essentially, it can be many different things. Let me just say that. But for example, two types, I'll give you an example, like critical peak rebate, where it would be pretty simple. You would get like a rebate for lowering your use during the critical peak times, or critical peak pricing, where you would, it's a little bit more complicated. There are several different prices, but you would, depending on how you brought your usage down from your baseline, you could save money as well. With that, it's not, there's a chance that your bill could go up, but with critical peak rebate, it's basically all carrot. A lot of people are not in favor of that because they feel, well, it doesn't really teach people, you know, to conserve. If you're getting a rebate if you cut back, but you're not being penalized for when you use it at more expensive times, you know, what kind of a message are you sending? But in terms of a specific plan, we don't have one in front of us now, but probably that is something that we will consider later in conjunction, you know, with the, to make the smart meters more effective. We did have a pilot program, some of you may have heard of, PowerSense DC, and that was a pilot program across the city that had a cross-section and did different pricing programs, and the overall results from the program were that people really enjoyed it, they were able to save money, and, you know, like 90% of the people said, you know, they did not want to go back to the averaging method of doing their electricity. Let me try to give you another example, and I'm going to modify this a little bit. Sometimes it's used as poundage, but I'm going to do it in a little bit of a different way. The way that we think of electricity would be analogous now, the way that it's billed, when I say the averaging is, you know, if you were to go into the supermarket and there were no prices on the shelves, and you went in and you picked up everything, you put it in your cart, and, you know, a lot of people would say, you know, do it by the poundage, like they just charged you per pound. But what I think makes it a little bit clearer is, you know, most people get their circulars and their coupons, and they go in, you know, and they're checking, you know, what's on sale, what do I see on the shelves, and, you know, this brand is for sale, and that's how they pick their items, and then they, you know, check out and know exactly how much they're spending. Imagine if you did none of that and you got your bill at the end of the month and they said, this is what you spent. You have no idea. You obviously would be very upset that, you know, that's not a proactive way to shop. So it's just a sort of a different way of thinking about it. Okay, another issue I think that people are concerned about is cybersecurity. A lot of people are concerned that, you know, the meters are on, they're accumulating all of this data about me. You know, they're telling my hourly usage. If I look at all of this data, someone could say they're at home at this hour, you know, they like to wash at this time, you know, what's going on in their house? It could be a little invasive. Well, let me just say, first of all, that, you know, there are just currently, even without getting into for the smart meters, there are rules in place under the Consumer Bill of Rights, and they're also in the statutes about your personal information being safeguarded, and that the electric utility is not allowed to give out any of your personal data without your written consent. So, you know, that's, you needn't be concerned that, you know, somehow now they're going to be able to, you know, give out your individual information, because they cannot. They are prohibited by law from doing that. Additionally, Pepco has signed on to a new White House initiative called Green Button. And Green Button basically is patterned after healthcare program that was set up at the Veterans Administration, where you will be able to basically go online and download your information in a readable format. You may then use that information as you choose. You could send it on to someone, you know, for a specific, like, app. You know, if you wanted to give it to a third party to say, you know, analyze this and tell me what I should do with it. But it will be in a format that you can read. You can take it right off the computer. You will be able, it'll be easy to understand, and it will be easy for you to send it without an issue. So you will be in control of that data. A little bit, well, not on the topic. Am I running out of time? Okay. You know, interestingly, I had another question that was, and this may be far afield, but you mentioned hydraulic fracturing, and I just want to mention that. Well, obviously, that's not going on in the district, but, you know, in nearby states, particularly in Pennsylvania, we have Marcellus and shale gas. This is a new, we now have additional reserves of natural gas in the United States that we've discovered. Natural gas is a clean burning fuel, and it's a good fuel to use. There are some concerns that it's harming the environment somehow. Well, the real key is to make sure that those who are performing the fracking are following best practices. It's not inherently an environmental danger. It's ensuring that they're doing it in a safe and responsible way. And if it's done in that way and it's monitored by the states, then it is, you know, a wonderful resource. The president, you know, in fact, mentioned it in one of his State of the Unions recently, that this is a great resource for us to have. So, you know, I just wanted to mention that that is a great source of fuel. Lastly, I will just state that the council recently revised the renewable portfolio standards, and they were raised, and that solar by 2023, the goal is to have 2.5% of our resources, of our fuels, to come from solar energy. So, I think that's really great, and about 20% will come from Tier 1 resources. So Tier 1 resources are, and this is in 2023, would be solar, wind, qualifying, biomass, geothermal, etc. Currently, the solar is about 6.5% is the goal for now. So I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you to all three of you.
Excuse me. For questions for any of the panelists, Gene.
I have two questions on energy usage. The first is, I've heard from some people about something called phantom load. It's described as all the electricity that you're using in your house that you don't know about. Anything like a television, a stereo, a computer, even when it's turned off, is using electricity. In a way, I don't know how much, but people say that nationwide it's a gigantic amount that we're wasting. And I just wondered if you could give us any thoughts about what we might be able to do to avoid using electricity needlessly. But it seems that everything that comes with a remote control is programmed in such a way that it continually draws power even when it's not operating. The second question has to do with gas. Because of the Marcellus Shale and everything, gas prices now are below $2 a thousand cubic feet, which is about 20 cents a therm. Not quite, but somewhere in that vicinity. And when I get my gas bill from Washington Gas, it shows just for the price of gas, 55 cents. Plus there's a 35-cent delivery charge on top of the 55 cents. So my question is, why is it 35 cents? Why does Washington Gas charge me 35 cents more than what they theoretically are buying the gas for? So those are my two questions.
Okay, so let me start with your first question, phantom load. Yes, that is in fact true. When you leave appliances plugged in, I mean, certain appliances stay plugged in all the time. But for example, if you want to save electricity, you can unplug your TV when you're not using it. You can unplug that lamp in the room you rarely go into. All of those, it does suck electricity. A lot of people call them vampires as well. They do suck electricity when you're not using it. That's how it works. Now, I know that particularly in California, they are starting to come out with standards, for example, with cell phone chargers, where once the cell phone is fully charged, it cuts off and it doesn't pull any electricity from the system, even though it's plugged in. But those are manufacturing things that would have to change. In the interim, you can unplug it. That will save you some money. In terms of the natural gas, you said that 35-cent charge on top, the delivery charge. Basically, what you're paying for is the use of the pipes to keep, you know, to actually deliver the gas to your house, separate from the commodity. The commodity costs a certain amount, then you have to pay a fee to actually get it to your home. And as well, there are other taxes on your bill that you will see.
Yeah, I understand that, but there are two 35-cent charges because the total is about a dollar, and it's made up of 55 cents of commodity charge
okay. And
35% of delivery charge. But the commodity charge of 55 cents should really only be 20 cents because of the price of the gas. So the gas is being marked up on the commodity level from 20 to 35, and then another 35 is being put on top of it. So my question is, why doesn't Washington Gas charge a commodity price that is reflective of what the market is rather than one that's so much higher than what the actual commodity market is?
Well, your commodity charge should be reflective of what the market is. If you feel that there's an error there, because that sounds like what that would be, you can come to the Public Service Commission. You can call or come in and see someone in our Consumer Services Division, and they will look over your bill. And oh, we have some, I think people think they can answer. But so I'll just finish. if you do have a concern, they can look over your bill and go over it with you and make sure that it is correct. And I think we have some questions.
I just wanted to say, I remember a few years ago when gas prices were so high, how happy I was that Washington gas prices were well below market, because they had a lot of long-term contracts. And I think that's what's working against them right now. But you're the person who would actually know that.
About their long-term contracts?
Yes.
Yes, they do have contracts. They do try to procure some in advance. But I can't tell you exactly what their contracts look like right now. I certainly could get back to you on that answer, but I don't have an answer about what their contracts look like right now. I'd have to look at that.
Yeah, that's right. It's futures contracts. So those prices were locked in a long time ago. And the prices on your bill, today's prices should be reflected several months from now. Maybe sometime during the summer. I don't know how far they in advance they purchase. But, well, at some point, that will be reflected in your bill.
I think a lot of us have received many phone calls, written things, other types of approaches from different companies, electric and gas, offering us a better deal. And some of them seem to be saying that one of the things they do is to use more sustainable fuel sources. It's very confusing. It's hard to know how to make a decision. I don't know if there's a sort of a question as to what things one can find and to help you in making decisions like that.
Yes. Let me just say this. You know, basically, the District of Columbia is deregulated, meaning that we allow for retail competition. So the calls that you get, we hope, are all from legitimate companies, and they should be. They should be. Yeah, they should not be doing that. They are trying to get you to purchase electricity or maybe even gas as well from them. But we do promote competition in the district. So, for example, if you did nothing, you would continue to be on the SOS, Standard Offer Service. However, if you did want to, for example, use cleaner energy, you said, you know, I really would like wind. That's how I would like to receive my power, and it's a good rate, and I want to sign up with them. You certainly can do that, and we encourage you to do that. If you have a concern, again, about an individual supplier, or you want help with that, our consumer services division will go over that with you. They can even mediate, you know, through that with you in terms of helping you to make sure you're making a selection that you're comfortable with. And you will still receive just one bill. You'll receive your Pepco bill. So if you want to do that, you definitely should.
I would just add, my wife and I buy all wind power. It costs a little more. And what you can do, you can't guarantee in any place you live necessarily what kind of energy is coming into your house that day, because it may come from a coal plant one day and a nuke the next, or natural gas the next. But you just guarantee that many kilowatts that you use are available and up on the grid someplace. And you've got, this year you've got a choice of local wind or national wind. But the more people do that, the more we convert the nation to being run more and more by renewables.
It's interesting that program is through Washington Gas. The 100% wind program is through Washington Gas.
Washington Gas Energy Services.
Thank you.
You understood that they were saying.
I understand Pepco is applying for a rate hike. Can you tell us what the basis of their request for the hike is and what the basis of the movement to deny it is?
Okay, so currently we have a rate request before us at the commission. Applying for a rate increase is within Pepco's right to do that. That's their statutory right. That's how they recover their expenses. That's how they make their money. That's how they get their money. They apply to the commission, and we, you know, look at all, you know, their, well, our experts look at all their books and take into consideration what they've spent and if it is whether their expenses were reasonably and prudently incurred, and make a decision about what that amount should be. So that is their right to do that. That is how they operate. They're a monopoly, and they're required to provide the service, and they are entitled to a reasonable rate of return. In terms of the, I was confused about your second question, what you were asking.
Excuse me. What is a reasonable return on their investment? And then, other than simply a knee-jerk reaction, what is the basis of the people who are claiming that it should be turned down? I mean, I understand there is movement afoot. I've received solicitations to sign a petition that asking your commission to turn it down. So I'm confused on what the basis is to ask to begin with. Other than a right, but I mean, they have to have some proof. And then what is the counter argument that it should be turned down?
Well, we held a week of evidentiary hearings. The case is ongoing. We're going to have more evidentiary hearings. They will be in May or June. The case is being adjudicated currently, so I cannot make any specific comments on the case, but to the extent that you would like to, it is open to the public, and you can either view it on the web or you can come to the proceedings, but I cannot get into any details about the case because it is a current pending case before the commission. So once we issue a decision, we will lay out in detail the basis for our findings.
Thank you. I want to congratulate those of you who worked on the sustainability plan. I think it is very exciting, and I like that enthusiastic introduction to it as well. So I have a couple questions around that. First one is, will there be cost projections for all the recommendations that eventually get into the final plan? Can you say something about does the time projection for what I think Ruth mentioned of this number of years and this number of years and this number of years, does that come with real choices for the citizens of the district as to how much we want to be looking to the long-range impact versus the short-range impact? Because that seems to me like such a major factor in all the decisions about becoming more green. Are you talking about today and how much you're going to pay in your monthly bill? Are you talking about, you know, what we'll have 20 years from now, or what your grandchildren will have, you know, 50 years from now? So that's the second part. The third one is, Laura, you said a renewable portfolio standard set by the council. I assume you mean the D.C. City Council. And how does that fit, just like setting, how does a council set a standard, and, you know, how is that something to do with the law when there are all these other factors at play? So I don't know what order or who should answer. But.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, the renewable portfolio standard's a law. You can say certain percentage has to come from this type of energy or that or this group of them or whatever. You can set the time it has to be met by and so on. I mean, it's been very effective in the United States, where the states have set that goal. That's how Texas became the leader in wind. By law, they
they set the thing in motion. Each of these things that each of the recommendations has a time frame. There's some time frames for quick action. For example, 1.5 million square foot of green roofs is the goal for next year, a very quick one. Others are long range by the year 2032. Now, as you get closer to one of those, you may make adjustments depending on how successful you've been. We're pushing for at least I would be pushing for maximum gathering of early results, because rather than worrying about the cost, I would say we should be focused on how much benefit we will get from sending all of our energy dollars out to these, what I think are very marginal operations that don't behave ethically with respect to the life on the planet. And the sooner we invest in things that keep the energy dollars at home, the better, cleaner, healthier we'll be, and we will be prospering our own economy rather than lining the pockets of people in distant places, including the damn mountaintop blaster removers who are turning West Virginia into a moonscape every single day of the year. So that's why I would focus on the benefits, which I think are really great.
Also, you said you talked in terms of generations.
Yes.
That's a good way to look at things, too. But this is a 20-year plan. So, we truly focus on what we can do in the next 20 years. And as Brent said, the mayor is really interested in what we can do tomorrow. And that's why on Tuesday is already going to release a list of actions that he wants to see council take in his budget that didn't go so well in council, but he asked the council for an appropriation of $5 million in the budget to start implementing the plan right away. So he's very serious about now, not so much the 20-year, but there are so many good ideas that came through the public process that clearly cannot be done tomorrow and need feasibility studies, they need a lot of preparation. Some things are incremental. You need to build kind of steps before you can get to other things. But also, I like what Brent said, focusing on savings. I mean, we really don't want to focus on spending because that's not really where we should focus right now. But a lot of sustainability really has to do with savings. So I want to give you energy is a clear one, you save energy. But, one that I really like is stormwater, right? We've had issues with stormwater. We've had issues of pollution in the Anacostia forever, right? So there's this EPA permit that we have. We have a new EPA permit, and it's the most aggressive permit in the country. That will force us, whether we like it or not, to be very, very aggressive on what we do to reduce pollution from stormwater, and so how we deal with stormwater. Now, there are different approaches you can take, right? Just to make it very simple, you can go the old route, they call it the gray infrastructure, big panels under the earth, you can build tanks and that kind of stuff. And the price tag is not millions, but billions of dollars. That's a very quick, not so quick, you have to build them, but it's a quick way to fix things. It's kind of an old engineering mentality about things. The problem with that, it's not only the price tag is billions of dollars, but who has the capacity to build an underground gigantic tank under the sea? There are only so few major engineering firms and construction firms that can do that. A lot of them are not based in D.C. That's a contract. You put it out, that tank gets built, the jobs go out, the money goes out. A smarter way that the city is intending to go about things from now and the future, well, we've been working on it for a few years, but from now in the future is to work on stormwater through what it's called green infrastructure, so LID, low impact development, if you know what that is. But so that's it. In a way, it's more complicated because it's more extensive. You know, you have to look at every roof as a potential sponge to retain and reuse stormwater. You have to look at every parking lot as a sponge to retain, and so on. So if you think about how big the district is and how many homeowners there are, how many buildings there are, how many streets there are, it's very complicated. But one great thing about that is that it's a solution for another problem, the jobs, right? Because green infrastructure, it's not one gigantic job construction, it's multiple little green infrastructure jobs that people in DC have the capacity to do, that you can train people in DC to do, because they're basically landscaping jobs. There's maintenance to it that creates more jobs, and it beautifies streets. So there are ways that we can solve some of our sustainability issues, in this case, the water quality in our rivers, creating jobs, saving money. So sustainability is really about being smart and going about problems, maybe not always the most forward way or the way you went at it for many, many years, but it's maybe the more complicated way. Maybe, you know, it's the harder way, but you can create other ripple effects that are important. But I'm sure, you know, we could talk about energy for hours, and there are millions of ways we can do smart choices energy-wise that create more jobs in the district. I mean, you know, when you install solar panels, you can contract with the DC business. When you buy energy from a nuclear plant in Pennsylvania, right? So, I mean, there are different ways. It's not only about cost.
I just wanted to follow up on that, because just before the meeting, Jane and I were talking about saving water on a roof, very specifically right here on Connecticut Avenue with our businesses. So, why don't you just comment on
that? Well, I guess I have another comment. I mean, one would be, take all this roof water, try and channel it to water the plants in the front, which is the same concept you're talking about. Pretty, I mean, a bit, somewhat. We're in the midst of doing a bunch of repairs, street beautification for this neighborhood, money in the DC budget for it, and it, in a way, it's so frustrating. We all know how frustrating this is, but it's frustrating that every little event in this process is totally independent of the next one. So even though we've talked a lot with many different representatives of DDOT, which is where the money's coming from, about, you know, using sustainable methods, trying to channel the water so that we actually could have trees, because our trees die because they don't get water. And there are lots of other cities doing this, so it's really frustrating to see the money kind of getting spent, boom, 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 but the big picture isn't really being solved. And I don't know if you guys have any comments on how that might be able to take place, or is there any leader work with DDOT and help direct them on the best practice? I mean, I don't know. Is there a way?
The way is in motion. Green infrastructure is a relatively new concept. It's a relatively new way of doing things. It's so new that every time we do something like that, we call it a pilot. We have some firms in DC that are specialized in green infrastructure, and they're still learning every day. I talk to them, and they say, oh, I went to blah, 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 and I learned this new technique. I mean, it's really an evolving field. Now, what you have to think about is roads have existed for a long, long time, and especially for the past so many years, they've been built always with the same standards. Very infrequently, the science of road work has changed. And this is a revolution. I mean, my boss, the director of the Office of Planning, she likes to think of roads, she likes to say that we should start thinking of roads not just as a vehicle for moving people, buses, bicycles, but also moving water. There should be as much as a green and water infrastructure as they are a transportation infrastructure. That sounds easy to say, but it's really hard to implement. We have a road network system that is gigantic, and we have, you know, systems too. And by the way, we don't control everything we do ourselves, right? I mean, our roads are... And what we can do with roads is highly regulated by the Federal Highway Administration. So Wisconsin Avenue is not just your little neighborhood road. It's there's so many things that Wisconsin Avenue has to do between emergency evacuations. And so it's very complex and it's frustrating. Working on roadways, it's very frustrating. But it's in motion. I mean, OP, DDOE, and DDOT work together on green infrastructure all the time. We have pilots together. And at times, there is also an issue of money. I mean, these things are more expensive. So depending on the money that you have, I know you guys just got new street lights. We're doing a new project in Glover Park, and people were surprised that we were not doing trees.
We'd
but we're doing...
Happy, yeah. I think
it
would.
What I would like
I will volunteer
with the two of you can continue this conversation. I hope we have just about 5 more minutes, and we do have a few more questions. And I know the final question on energy hasn't been answered yet, but I wanted to give a couple more people a chance to ask questions. So back here, and then Mark.
Thank you. My name is Chris Turner. Commissioner Lee, a couple of quick questions. On January 13th of 2012, Santa Cruz County in California, the Board of Supervisors asked their health services agency to study.
Well, not to pile on to the commission, but I would like to contest your declaration that fracking has been demonstrably proven to be safe. There is considerable debate about it, both in terms of groundwater pollution, and if you'd look at this morning's post, in terms of earthquakes that are being caused. So I would challenge the commission to go back and look at the evidence and not to declare it as fact in a public meeting until there's been a hearing about this. A second question to OP on sustainability very quickly. Is I understand and applaud your approach to sustainability, but there's something I think missing from it. And I would query OP about the value in factoring in questions of historic preservation, questions of neighborhood culture and ambience, questions about preserving that which some people and some communities find precious, and the notion of sustainability going beyond an equation that does not account for some of those more human and cultural factors.
So it's a longer discussion, and I'm glad you brought it up, but we can't pursue it in every detail that you would like to tonight. Maybe we can find a way to look into it more, but just a few words and then. Thank you. One last quick question. We're really... out of time, you have.
Okay, this is a quick question, and a quick answer is all it requires. The city has a number of major developments on its plate right now, and the mayor is very excited about them. I'm wondering if in return for the gifts that the city gives to the developers, LEED certification will be required.
I'm not sure what you want me to answer. It's not. I don't know what gifts you're talking about. So, but we do have. We do have legislation that requires buildings of a certain size to be LEED certified. So,
already
it's kind of repetitive. We already have that legislation. I mean, most big commercial buildings already have to be. I think it's LEED Silver. So, I mean.
Actually, the city leads the country, right, in LEED certification, which is interesting. We're going to have to wrap this up. I want to thank all three panelists, and I want to say that we can continue this conversation through the Greening Committee. I think lots of things have come up, and what we didn't really get into very much tonight is what we can be doing here. I mean, that's why, Jane, I was glad to hear your concern about the water from the roofs of along Connecticut Avenue. But we really need, this isn't just something we say, oh, Brent's an environmentalist, oh, Andrea, he's on the Office of Planning, oh, Laura, she's with the PSC. They're not going to just take care of it for us. It's really our own involvement and looking, at what we can do here in Cleveland Park. So I want this to be a beginning. And thank you very, very much for coming and being on the panel. Thank you.
I also want to say a word of thanks to Ruth for putting together this fabulous panel and discussion. It was quite wonderful. And to all of you for coming and staying and generating a really interesting conversation. Thanks.